Just when I think producer Sam can't get any more Canadian, he tells you before the show, instead of being like, Jeff, we're about to start the podcast. Can you please get into character? Instead of that, yeah. He goes, hey, could you cut the tunage, bud?
Yeah, turn down your tunage. Just listen to some Nine Inch Nails here before the show. Turn down your tunage. It's bleeding through your mic. Sam's the best, but you know what? Right before that, he was lamenting the Jays lost yesterday at the hands of Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And said, I was crying into my Labatt 50. For all you Canadian beer drinkers, you know that is a very Canadian pull. I was crying into my Labatt 50.
I put this forward last night.
I
put this forward on Twitter last night, and it's one of the things I really do believe, not only in sports but in life, that when you're a fan of multiple teams in the same city, they all can't be going well at the same time. So I really do believe that the arrival of Austin Matthews put the scales up, and then at the same time, the Jays' fortunes turned in the ALCS. Can't have two good things at the same time in a sports city.
Really? Explain Cleveland. Cleveland to me then, sir. Twice, they're sticking it to a Toronto team.
Well, I mean,
they beat us in basketball. They're going to beat us in baseball.
In LeBron's case, I mean, they haven't started their season yet. They could open 0-15 for all we know.
No, but last year, starched us.
It's an even Steven thing. That's why as a Jets fan, my team blows. And wait, nope, all my teams blow right now. Yeah, it's a terrible theory.
Okay. That's comforting. You know what else blows? Fanager's gone. That's what blows.
I'm happy for
Tom Peraska. So happy for Tom. That's great. That's a lot of, you know, sweat equity he put into that website. And I know I'm being selfish by saying, damn it. You know, one of the first tabs that I open every single day, and I keep open every single day, is General Fanager.
Mm-hmm.
It's just depressing now.
It's such a great go-to. I reached out to him this morning. He obviously can't talk on the record or even want to talk off the record at this point about the gig. But the thing I'm wondering about it is, you know, when the Leafs bought up Extra Skater, when they hired Daryl for their brain trust.
Yep.
Part of the reason they did so was to take all that information out of the public forum. Now, do you think there's any facet of that in trying to take General Fanager offline? Is trying to
no.
like because here's the no. thing: does every team have that information that would have been on
yes.
Fanager? They do.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Yes, or they just call Central Registry. But yeah, everybody has access to all that.
So they're just hiring him for his expertise.
It's funny, I got a text from someone last night who said, wow, NHL teams are really in love with guys that do good coding.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's what a lot of these sites were / still are.
Right.
Great coding. Great coders out there. A lot of respect for those guys. That is a very quiet story that is being underreported, how much respect NHL teams have for those guys and gals.
Well,
coding.
I mean,
you know what? Listen. Your Bible, Greg, your Bible was wrong. The meek shall not inherit the earth. The geek shall inherit the earth. Let's just all remember that now.
That was actually the first.
Flying into my face yesterday.
That was actually the first draft of the Bible. They had geek.
And oh, is it? I thought it might have just been a typo. Just a typo
someone,
in the Bible for
someone read it as Someone read it as Greek. They got really offended.
Oh,
listen,
yeah.
The bottom line is this. Coders get hired because the old people that run hockey teams are fascinated by things they don't understand. And they just hire people that can do the things they don't know how to do and assume that they're super geniuses. I'm interested because specifically with Tom's hiring, right? Like, this is a team that obviously is going to be running an expansion draft next summer. And one of the things that's on his site that was quite popular was the expansion draft.
I was addicted.
Yeah.
It was a drug.
So I wonder if they're using that technology, or they specifically wanted to acquire that technology to run different scenarios. I don't know.
Wouldn't surprise me. Listen, Tom's a smart guy. Like Tom did, you know, full disclosure, Tom did a lot of consulting for us at Sportsnet in the last 2 years. Like a lot. We had like various exclusivity over Tom to do a lot of the salary cap work for us. Salary cap stuff around July 1st, salary cap stuff around the trade deadline. You know, Tom was a pretty valuable consultant for us at Sportsnet. Really valuable. And that's where I got to know him a little bit. He gave a presentation before all of us, before trade deadline. Last year. Gave this huge, like, hour-long presentation in front of everybody. Like, producers, executive producers, front-facing camera people, like, everything. All of them. Tom holds a room for an hour, explaining the ins and outs of the salary cap on all 30 teams and what it could mean for trade deadline.
Knowing him like you know him and knowing what he can offer.
I just know him a little bit.
But what do you think he can offer this team? Like, what do you think they saw that you saw maybe in that presentation to say, okay, we need to hire this guy?
He understands the CBA.
Yeah.
I don't think you can have enough guys that really understand the ins and outs of the CBA. Yes, we'll get to you, Edmonton, stand by. the ins and outs of the collective bargaining agreement. And I don't think you'd have too many people that can understand how to play with the salary cap and what's out there and who can understand all 30, soon to be 31 teams around the NHL and where they're at with their cap, where they're vulnerable, where they're strong, where there are weak points, what you can exploit. It's never a bad idea to have smart people around your organization. And Tom is one of the brighter guys out there. There's a lot of really bright guys out there. You know, one of the smartest was one of the early hires, and that's Eric Tulsky in Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing about these sites, damn it. You get addicted to them, and then the NHL pays attention, says, shit, we should get these smart guys in here, and then they're gone. Mm-hmm. Then they just vanish. Like, the one thing, okay. I think I mentioned this on the podcast last year. I had one NHL team sort of indirectly reach out to me to see if I'd be interested in working for them. And my answer back was, well, what can I do? You know, I kind of just talk about things that other people do. What can I do for an organization? Like, honestly, what could I offer you? Like, in my capacity in this industry, I would be quite comfortable and not offended if someone said, Merrick can offer us nothing. Because it's true. What am I offering? Like, listen, honestly, dude, what am I offering? Nothing. But a guy like Tom, a guy like, you know, Tyler Dello, a guy like Eric Tulsky, like, go right down the list, Brian McDonald in Florida. Like, these kinds of guys can offer something. They can do something to make your team better. And that is some of the more intriguing stuff that's being published and that's being worked on right now online. The problem with that is we should never lose sight of one thing. I mean, look at how great Dmitry Filipovich is, you know, between his writing, between his podcasts, like all of it. Don't forget, at the end of the day, these guys have a skill set that can translate to good work with an NHL team. Unlike my end of the business where I say, that's a bad pass and, ooh, I thought that was offside.
Look.
Jesus, what am I doing?
You're kind of
nothing.
You're no selling it. The truth of the matter is that the team reached out to Merrick hoping to have an in when TJ Merrick turns pro and is draft eligible.
Yeah. Worked out great with the Maple Leafs hiring Jimmy Vesey's dad.
Exactly. The Jimmy Vesey thing happened and then the team lost interest. They're like, this whole father thing's BS. It doesn't work.
But speaking of kids hockey, I had a really cool experience the other day. Our 4-year-old is playing hockey now, right? Brody's playing now. He's having a great time and he loves it. Him and his brother get to play together, like Shinny and stuff. But he started in his own league, right? Where our older son, TJ, started too. And so I'm talking to the head coach. I'm just one of the assistants, right? Just go out and help the kids. And I'm getting Brody dressed, and the coach says, yeah, we have this new kid who's going to be playing on our team, this kid Ty. I'm like, okay, well, that's wonderful. That's great. Look forward to meeting this guy, 4-year-old, right? And so, sure enough, Ty comes in, and he sits down beside us, and his dad's getting him dressed, and I look up, and we kind of lock eyes, and he's like, hey, Merrick. And I look at him, and I go, hey, Rafi Torres.
Whoa.
So my kid's playing hockey with Rafi Torres' kid now. Yeah.
Now, hold on the same team?
Yeah, man.
Okay.
Yeah, Ty's a good little player, too.
You're fine.
He's a good little skater.
Everything's fine. On the other team, watch out. Head up.
Yeah. That's a different game.
Yeah, you know.
No contact. There's no contact at that
level. Ty Torres is the kind of teammate you like on your team. But if you have to play against him, oh, boy. He's a tough one.
They're 4 years old. They're learning to stop.
Mm-hmm.
But that was that was nice.
I wish Rafi learned how to stop.
I was always, and I've been on record on this podcast as being Camp Torres from day one.
I know. At least, I mean, listen, I think he, Listen, unlike someone like Patrick Coletta, who I never thought could play,
yeah, I think Torres could play.
Rafi could play.
Yep.
Rafi could play.
Just the injuries, man. That guy's body, holy smokes. By the end, I can only imagine. Like, and the weird thing is, I was thinking about this. I was driving home. I was talking to my wife. I'm like, yeah, it must be bizarre to go through your career. And then, you know, you feel terrible, but, you know, you're going to take some time to heal up. And you're going to take some time to get better. But then knowing that, you know, even 20 years from now, something might happen, which has its root cause in something that happened 40 years previous.
Yeah, right?
Man, it's hard. That's why at the end of it all, I'm pretty consistent on this podcast. I have tons of respect for all these guys, regardless of your skill set, regardless of your player number 730 in the NHL. What you do to your... Dude, Cody Hodgson just retired a couple of weeks ago at 26. Because the body breaking down.
I think it's the body.
And has been going back to the false starts that he got in Vancouver a couple different times, the back injuries. Anyway, what were we talking about? Oh yeah, Tom Prochazka.
All right, listen. Let's talk about this league a little bit. A couple things we wanted to discuss before Brad True Living comes on the show today to talk about how no one realized that one of the options was just pay Johnny Gaudreau as much as Mark Giordano. Not more, not less, just as much. That's a great idea. What a concept. Yeah. The New York Islanders are 1-2 right now. Okay. Mm-hmm. What's your vibe on that team? Because I picked them to finish outside the playoffs. Do you think it's a playoff team this year?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Doesn't look like a playoff team to me at all, and I can only imagine the frustration that John Tavares is going through. I said on the last podcast, I cannot think of one elite level centerman who's had more of a revolving door around him of wingers. Which has got to be endlessly frustrating for someone of the skill set and quality of John Tavares.
And the latest two to get an audition with Johnny T, Andrew Ladd, 3 games, no points, and Jason Chimera, 3 games, 1 point. Lad's playing 19.05 per game. He doesn't have a point yet.
Yep.
I realize that amongst the available players on left wing in this offseason, Andrew Ladd's pretty near the top of the list. And I don't think anyone's going to be surprised if he pops 25 goals this year. I just don't think he's getting there.
Did we ever find out, because I didn't, what the real story was between the Islanders and Kalaposo? Like, why was it? I mean, no. All season long last year, nothing. No, well, they're going to get together and talk. Well, they're going to try to figure out. Well, they're going to see if, like, the beginning of last year, everybody knew this guy was walking. Why?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
He's already an asset for the Sabres. So it's like.
Well, they need him more than ever.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, 2/3 of your first line's injured.
You were professing before the start of the podcast your unending love for the newfangled 2-0
all in
plus two goal differential Colorado Avalanche.
All in. Best game of the year so far. Okay, it's a, you know, barely a 7-day
on. Jesus Christ, Merrick, best game. 3 games at most.
I'm sorry, man. Okay, so I watched a TV show on Saturday night. You know me, I don't watch much television, but I watched a TV show which I've seen before. And I thought at times they might cancel it, but they didn't. They stuck with it. And then this show on Saturday was one of the best shows that I've seen all season long. You know what the show was called?
What's that?
The show was called The Colorado Avalanche versus the Dallas Stars. It was an awesome TV show. About 2.5 hours, 3 hours long. It ended up being a 6-5 game. And the freaky thing to me, well, first of all, Joe Colbert in his debut gets the hat trick.
Yeah, crazy.
Colorado is playing a wildly exciting style of game, not unlike what we saw the Dallas Stars, their opponent on Saturday, and how they played last season. But where once upon a time, if Semyon Varlamov laid an egg, Colorado went along with them.
Yeah.
But Varlamov, he wasn't good on Saturday night. And you know what Colorado did? They still won the game. When did that ever happen with Patrick Waugh there?
Yeah.
And when did they ever play that style? They go down 2-0 last night to the Pittsburgh Penguins, right? Pittsburgh's in charge right off the hop. And who comes clawing back to win that thing? Your Colorado Avalanche. I know it's two games, but I'm in.
I'm feeling really good about having Nathan MacKinnon on my fantasy team. But the thing about Colorado is this: like, I wanted to find a place for them in the playoffs because I love the idea of Jared Bednar. I love the idea of someone coming in and not only mm-hmm. being a winner at every level, which I think is important. I think, like Bruce Boudreau, you have a bag of magic pixie dust that you can sprinkle on any team and all of a sudden turn them around. He's kind of got that, like Cooper had that, like Boudreau has that. I wanted to find a place for him, but the problem is that someone has to fall out. And St. Louis ain't falling out, clearly. I don't think Dallas is. I think Boudreau finds a way to get Minnesota in, although I know there are a lot of people that don't believe that.
This is the biggest challenge of outside of getting the Caps in 208. This is the biggest challenge he's had.
Nashville's in, and until proven otherwise, Chicago's in. And I think with Chicago, the situation is that if the kids they're trying to play aren't ready, and it's obvious that they need to do something dramatic, they'll do it. But they're not. There's just not a team that's going to take a step back. They're going to get aggressive and try to fix it.
That'll be a test for Stan Bowman. That is a test of his creativity.
Of his cap management.
But that's going to happen in a cap room. I mean, you can only dine out that high. I mean, how many times did they duck when the axe swung?
Yeah.
Right? Every time they'd win the Stanley Cup, they'd have to get rid of about $20 million worth of contracts of quality hockey players and still come back and then competitive. And then, oh, look at that. 2 years later, they won a Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
You can only dine out at that restaurant for so long.
Right, and then stumble into a pile of gold coins when like Brad Richards gets bought out, and then you get him for $1 million.
You back up into Artemi Panarin.
Right. So my point is that someone has to fall out of that Central Division playoff picture for the Avalanche to get in, and you seem to believe it would be the Wild most likely.
I love Bruce Boudreau. I think Bruce Boudreau is a hell of a coach. Man, this is a tall order. I don't know about this one, man. Streak may be over for Bruce. But again, it's early, and health of everybody is going to be a major issue. Colorado, they suffer, one huge injury. It could be it for them. I still don't like their depth. I still don't like their, the composition of their defensemen. But I'm just saying, as far as a TV show that I want to watch this year's TV show called The Colorado Avalanche because the two games that we've seen from the Avs have been outstanding.
So this is fun. So if the Avs get in, Bednar wins the Jack Adams. If the Wild get in, Boudreau might win the Jack Adams. And then if the Kings get in, Daryl Sutter might get the Jack Adams. But if they don't get in, he could be fired.
Could be fired.
Right. By the way, first coach fired during the 2016-17 season, Boveda just released the odds.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
John Tortorella leads the way at 13-4. Willie Desjardins, 7-2. Jack Capuano, 15-4. I would take those odds. Michel Therrien, 11-2. Claude Julien, then Paul Maurice, then Alain Vigneault. I think my pick was Desjardins. Only because everyone, I think, me and myself included, thought that the bottom would drop out in Vancouver at some point. Maurice is an interesting one. I feel like he may have more stability there than we give him credit for, but the expectations are raised for the Jets.
Expectations are raised for the Jets. Why?
Do you don't think that they fancy themselves as being more of a contender this year than last, or do you think they're still in a holding pattern?
I think, you still have Jacob Trouba on the outs. I don't know how you fire Paul Maurice. Like, philosophically, Kevin Cheveldayoff doesn't have that player, doesn't have anything for that player, and you're going to hang the coach for it?
No, I agree.
I don't know. You going with young goaltenders? I don't know, man.
No, like, but that's what I'm saying.
I think Winnipeg's a better team than a lot of people give them credit for.
Uh-huh.
And I know talking about them like I am, maybe I'm not giving them enough credit. I just don't know that expectations are as extremely high as you may think they are. I think they would like to get back into the playoffs.
But that's what I mean by stability. Like, I think there are mitigating factors that are going to keep them there, and part of the mitigating factors is the fact that the core of the team, for the most part, is pretty damn young.
Mm-hmm.
I think they see him as a guy that the team grows with versus we need to have somebody come in and change the results. Because they're playing the long game there. For God's sakes, they just drafted Line A.
And don't forget, this is an organization that does not fire people.
Or make trades.
or make trades. And I think Kevin Cheveldayoff's going to sit. Like, there's no pressure point right now for Cheveldayoff and Jacob Trouba.
Right.
So I think Kevin Cheveldayoff is fine just to sit there.
But here's the thing
and
with
wait
this
for
top
a point.
With this top pick, like you got to understand two things. You have to understand who hired Tortorella in Columbus, and the answer is John Davidson. Right, and then you have to also remember what Columbus is, which is a team that is probably losing a lot of money because they're not successful on the ice. They don't have playoff revenue. They don't have a massive amount of fans at every game. They would owe John Tortorella a pretty considerable amount of money if they fired him this year, wouldn't they?
Yeah. This would be like, you know, Columbus and, you know, Doug McClain goes to the owner and says, I want to fire Dave King. I want to bring in a new coach. He says, okay, you can fire Dave King. You're going behind the bench.
Right.
Because I'm not paying someone to not coach and right. then hire another coach.
That's right. That's why you had in Jersey after DeBoer got canned, you had, I'll just go back there with two other guys and we'll do this for the rest of the season.
Whatever. It'll be fine.
By the way, my favorite thing this week I discovered is on Hockey Reference, for that part of the Devils season when it was Lou and Oates and Stevens coaching the team.
Yeah,
it's Pete DeBoer, parentheses, however many games he coached, and then N bench for the rest of the games. I don't know what the N stands for.
N bench?
N period bench. Like almost his name was Ned Bench. It says N bench. Oh wait. It's probably numerous, right? It's like
I don't know. I've never heard that.
Isn't
N
that
bench. I like Ned better. Ned bench.
On Hockey Reference, N bench for the rest of that season. No, I still think it's Jay Jordan. Wouldn't surprise me if it's Capuano, only because he's been there for so long. And I don't think Tortorella's going anywhere this season, no matter how bad they are.
If the Florida Panthers, and they have some key injuries right now to Bukestad, and Huberto's gone for a long time, if the Florida Panthers have a horrible stretch, would it surprise you if Gerard Gallant was the first guy?
Very.
And then I'll give you the scenario. Tom Rowe goes behind the bench. Eric Joyce is the general manager.
Oh, Jesus.
Tom Rowe's been a coach more than a manager.
I know, but this is the part of the Panthers I don't like to think about.
Well, the part of the Panthers where they want their guys in there, and they're going to
put
their guys
in there. Yes, the stupid, insular, we're hiring our own people and firing the good people thing that they're doing there. It's the part I don't want to think about.
No?
The part
it is
where...
It is a thing there, and we all know it, and every NHL team that you talk to knows it.
See, that's ridiculous, Merrick. That'd be the kind of thing you'd expect from a team that sends the owner's son to the NHL draft. Oh, jeez. Look what I did there. Before that, one more team we got to talk about in the West, though, as far as like...
By the way, in Travis's defense, from a lot of the people that I talked to, he's a wonderful guy.
Sure.
Meaning, it might mean nothing, mm-hmm. but as far, like, he's not a sort of insidious backstabber.
Absolutely.
From all indications, and I don't know Travis, but all indications that people that I've talked to, he's a fantastic guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's no Eric Trump, but, you know.
It's a pretty low standard. He's a good guy. He's not like Eric Trump. Come on.
He's not a craven monster.
Quite the bar you've set.
Who looks like he's wearing the mask of a human to mask his lizard face. The other team we should probably talk about, because this is, I think, a big change since last time you and I spoke, the LA Kings, losing Jonathan Quick for a long time.
Ooh, man.
The Jeff Zatkoff show. Everybody before the season's like, who's going to be the Montreal Canadiens this year, where they lose a key player and then fall off the map? Because they can't recover from that loss. And I guess the question is, are the Kings... Two questions. Are the Kings good enough to sustain this loss? And two, if they find out pretty quickly that the Peter Budaj, Jeff Zatkoff duo isn't good enough to try to salvage this thing, how aggressive do they get knowing that Quick will eventually come back?
Because
they can't be Ben Bishop aggressive, although that would be a season salvaging thing. At least I don't think they can.
No, don't think they can either. They can't be Marc-Andre Fleury aggressive.
No.
Honestly, I think you have to wait this one out and go with Zatkoff Budaj. Like, don't you think one of the problems though with LA is the lack of depth of defense that they have, where that used to be like the strong suit of the LA Kings? They're the possession monsters with the amazing defense. They have never recovered from the Slava Voynov situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
just
why
like
they...
in pure hockey sense. Okay?
Yeah.
Outside of, you know, the atrocity. They've never recovered from that loss.
Right. That's why they wanted to push their morals aside and find a way to keep him on the team. Because they knew that was they were building something with him cemented in to a certain spot for the next 5 or 6 years, and then they lost them all of a sudden. But you're right. Doughty, Muzzin, McNabb, Martinez, Green, and Forbort are your 6D right now. That's not deep.
Yep. Nope. And you lose Jonathan Quick, and you have the Marian Gabrick situation. Like, it ain't good, man. It ain't good in LA. But every year there is one team, and maybe sometimes there's two.
Yeah.
But again, two games in, bud.
I am fully aware of that. Two games in. No snap judgments here, except to say... Colorado's awesome.
Me going out. Yeah. Colorado.
Oh, and the Leafs are awesome, too. Let's not forget about the Leafs.
Oh, they beat the Boston Bruins, man. That murderer's row on the blue line.
Bruins are real. You talk about teams needing some D. Jeez.
They need some D. They should be all over. And I'm sure they have made the phone calls about Jacob Trouba.
But how do you do it, though? Like, what is... Oh, you right. You have this... But they're looking for a commiserate player, but I don't think he's a commiserate player.
The conversation would start with Charlie McAvoy.
I know that. But is that going to be enough to get him? They want someone who's already a fully formed Jacob Trouba in this league. Good luck with that, but that's what they want.
What about Jacob Trouba to the Penguins for Olli Maatta and a prospect?
See that? You're getting closer.
Mm.
Who's the prospect? Is it Connor Sheary?
I don't know. I don't know. Like, I'm just pulling that out of no. I'm just thinking about, because we all have, I think, you know, where the potential landing spot could be. I wonder if Trouba could be a fit in Pittsburgh.
Torrey Krug, Dominic Moore.
Not enough. And Ryan Spooner. Not enough for the Caramel Secret. I'm sorry. No thanks. Now you're just trying to embarrass me. This is Kevin Cheveldayoff hanging up. Goodbye.
I say good day, sir.
I say good day. Yeah.
I don't know. I still think Trouba ends up being Drouin. I think he comes back for.
I'm with you. I think
and you see, we say Drouin, but honestly, the comparison that should be made is Turris, which is another Oberhart client.
No, I don't think he's Turris because Turris ended up getting his way.
Well, he didn't really get it. He got his way via trade, but he had to come back on a deal. And I think that's what we're seeing now is he's going to come back on a 2-year deal. Around November or December and keep requesting a trade and see what happens, right?
Just make it really miserable there?
Well, I don't... Well, he's going to make it real... Well, you know what happens when you do that? Your clothes end up in the ice bath.
Fair point. Fair point. I forgot about that. Who's the next sweatsuit in the shower?
I don't think this is a situation where he's ever going to not be... under contract and traded. I think he needs to be on, because he's costing himself a little bit now by sitting out.
There's no pressure point there. Like, there's a pressure point, I would argue, already with the Anaheim Ducks and Hampus Lindholm. But there's still, it doesn't feel like there is a pressure point for Winnipeg and Jacob Trouba yet.
Not yet.
But man, there is for Anaheim. And this is one I don't know how they get out of. $300,000 in cap space.
Oh my God. Pat Clark, you just saw
Thomas Chabot's making his debut tonight for the Ottawa Senators against the Arizona Coyotes?
No, close. Patrick Clark sends us this from Hockey Reference in reference to what we were just speaking to before.
Oh, about Ned?
It's not Ned Bench. It's NJD Bench. But here's the amazing part of finding out the mystery of N Bench. Where the headshot would be on Hockey Reference, where you would see what the coach looks like, it's literally a picture of the Devil's Bench.
Oh my God, I just clicked on it. That's excellent.
That's fantastic. By the way, nobody's sponsored NJD Bench yet, if you're interested in buying that page for Hockey Reference. By the way,
or starting your own Twitter account, NJD Bench, at NJD Bench.
If I may be so bold, and maybe our next guest can also take this pledge. Let's get all 31 NHL teams to pledge not to hire whoever runs Hockey Reference. That's the site I can't live without. There's other salary cap sites out there. If someone takes Hockey Reference away, not only is it going to ruin most of my writing, but it's also going to be taking away my biggest time suck as well.
Let's ask Brad for living this. Of course, the general manager of the Calgary Flames who joins us now. And Brad, first of all, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us. Big game tonight against the Buffalo Sabres. But you know, one of the big pieces of news yesterday online was the death of GeneralManager.com. Tom Peraska gets absorbed by, you know, the new Las Vegas organization. I was trying to bring up the point earlier that NHL people are in love with people with, you know, guys and gals that do really good coding work, that that's, you know, valuable, and you can never have enough smart people in your organization. How much time do you spend surfing these websites that are online, whether it's, you know, General Fanager or, you know, some of the previous analytics sites? How much time do you spend on the internet, Brad?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. I would say not as much as maybe we produce a lot of that stuff internally right now, in terms of sort of our own data and what, you know, the types of things that we're recording. You're always looking what's out there, what's maybe the new, you know, is there new information? I still am very active in terms of trying to look and find, you know, information or turn over every rock. Probably though, like I said, there was a barrage of this information a few years ago, and you've kind of slowly filtered it down to trying to say, okay, what makes sense and what can you really draw from? And so, yeah, I'd say I'm still pretty active to looking, you know, and sourcing and digging around with different sites that are out there, but probably spend more time now just with a lot of our own data, and we've been able to sort of, you know, get it a little bit more narrow scope and probably spend more time there.
Since we mentioned our new friends in Vegas, what's been your take on the effect the expansion draft's going to have on the trade market in particular? Is there increased chatter? Is there less chatter? Do you think it's going to force some things? Or do you think that teams know that maybe they can make some problems go away by virtue of exposing certain players in the draft?
Well, I think, first of all, it's you're quite aware of it, and I think it's influenced some decisions to date. Maybe not as prevalent that people would pick up on right away, you know. But it's certainly pushed some signings that have happened to make sure that you're compliant in terms of the players that you have to expose. Number one, and then number two, I think as time goes along, it certainly will be the driver in the trade market to a certain extent. You know. I think everybody, we're no different. Everybody's done at least a very, you know, preliminary study, not only of your own team, but of all the other, you know, at this point, 29 teams, of who may be vulnerable in certain situations. And we've sort of slotted teams in different groupings in terms of where the issues may be and is there an opportunity for us, you know, with one of those situations out there. So I think everybody's done that. As the season gets up and going, your first priority is how do we win, you know, how do we try to win a hockey game first. But I think as time goes on here and as we get closer to, you know, as we get closer to the draft, I think it will push some deals, specifically because of the expansion draft and some of the protection lists. And no matter what you do, and every transaction that you look at right now, you have that in the back of your mind. Okay, if I'm going to add player X, what does it do to me in terms of the expansion? So it's prevalent, and I think it'll become more so as we get closer to the end of the year.
I can remember working the draft floor last year for Sportsnet, Brad, and I don't think you and your organization could get up to the podium fast enough when you saw that Matthew Tkachuk was still available when you picked him. What's your analysis and observations of Matthew Tkachuk so far early in the season?
Well, he's been really good right from day one, even coming into rookie camp. I mean, we always want to pump the brakes here a little bit with 18-year-old players. You know, Matthew's a late birthday, so he's, you know, you kind of view him almost a little bit older. He is a little older than a lot of those guys in his draft class. But he came in really from day one of rookie camp and, you know, has found that level at each, you know, so far each step of the way, whether it be rookie camp, whether it be the first, you know, and then it ratchets it up as you get into main camp and the big boys arrive and then into the preseason. So we're excited to have him. You know, he's still finding his way here a little bit in the early going. So we continue to monitor him and work with him daily, but we think that he's going to be a terrific player, for a long time in this league. So we're excited to have him.
Just as a follow-up to that, because I think a lot of hockey fans and observers make a big deal of, you know, game number 9 and then game number 10 for a hockey player, for a rookie. What's more important to your organization, a rookie playing game 9 or game 39 in past?
Well, they're both, they have some relevance. If you said what's one more, what's, you know, the accrued season probably at the end of the day is maybe more important. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, what takes precedent, whether it's game, you know, obviously there's these mile markers for the first year players, but what really has to take precedent is at the end of the day, where is he best served, number one? How, in this case with Matthew, how is he best served in his development? Is it here? You know, very rarely, and I subscribe to the theory that, you know, 18-year-olds, the norm is they number one, they don't necessarily help you win, and number two is there's very few of them where the best thing for them is to be in this league at that age. Now, there always is exceptions, but so that's really, obviously we work within those mile markers. But the question we ask each and every day is, okay, is he getting the requisite amount of minutes? Is it helping or hurting his development where he's at right now? And ultimately, number two is what's best for the Calgary Flames? You know, is he helping us win? And when you get to a stage that you're playing in this league, the number one question is, how do you help us win? And what's best for the players? So we'll continue to monitor it each day, and then as those mile markers come up, we'll take that into account as well. But to this point, I can't say enough. He's you know, he just gets it. He's not overwhelmed by anything, on or off the ice. You know, you can tell that he's been around the dressing room at a very young age, and his game continues to. He's improving each and every day, so we think we've got a good one here, and we'll continue to work with him and monitor it.
So Johnny Gaudreau, everybody in the media was really stressed out about, oh my God, will they pay him more than Giordano makes against the cap, or less than what Giordano makes against the cap? And none of us thought for a second, oh, what if they just pay him as much? Which is kind of what happened. So the question is, how hard was it to get to that number with the Gaudreau camp?
Well, every contract has its own, you know, its own challenges. I think in Johnny's case, it was unique in a couple different scenarios. First of all, there's very few guys. I mean, it's very limited. I think Patrick Kane maybe is the only player that has done what Johnny's done in his first 2 years in the league. You know, in terms of his point production. So he's a special talent. The challenge with all these is you know, it's a small body of work in terms of 2 years. And then trying to fit it in the overall, as I said at the time of Johnny's signing, is, you know, you want to, number one, look after Johnny and get something that works for him, but you're also trying to build a team. And in a cap system, you know, once that money is spent, you got to get it from somewhere else. It's got to come off somewhere else. So you're trying to, you know, slot them in accordingly, get them looked after. Johnny's a huge part of our team, a core piece that, you know, has shown it can be a top point producer in this league. And then, you know, as you move forward in the years ahead, you also need to continue to surround him and your other players with depth throughout the organization. So it was a bit of a push and pull here. At the end of the day, you know, I think you know, it's a great fit for both sides. I think Johnny gives him financial security at a young age, but also for us, it brings him in at a number that we can continue to build you know, throughout the years here and can keep growing our team.
Philosophically, Brad, when you consider a couple of things, you know, a lot of players, you know, they're, you know, well onto the back nine by the time they're 30, they can see the clubhouse. When you look at production for forwards, statistically between that sweet spot of 24 to 26 or maybe 27, that's when you're a peak performer. Are we sort of coming around to the idea now that the idea of the bridge contract is really done? When a player's career could be over at 30 and their peak is around 25 or 26, is the bridge deal just getting close to being done in the NHL, Brad?
I don't know if it's being close to being done, Jeff. Like each player is different. You know, each player is a little bit differently. You know, in the case of John, you know, we looked at a bunch of different scenarios, but ultimately the desire for both sides was to look at something long term. Really, it's twofold. It comes down to ultimately, like everything else in this business, it's player evaluation. Where do you project the player to be? And, you know, you're seeing it more and more now, those players coming out of entry level, you know, those top players, when you project where their production, where their growth is going to be, you know, you want to lock them up for as long as you can during the prime years of their career at a number that makes sense. So I still think it's a case by case scenario. It's a team by team scenario, a little bit of where you are at in terms of your cap situation and what monies you do have available. So I wouldn't say that the bridge deal is, you know, gone by the wayside. I think each you're going to continue to see them, and in some cases it makes a lot of sense for the reasons I just talked about. If you're still trying to determine where that player's value is and where that production may go to, and then twofold of where at that particular time where you're at from a team standpoint in terms of a, you know, cap situation. So I think you're continuing to see it, and it just it's a case by case scenario.
Last one for me, Brad, and thanks again for coming on. Your team has the misfortune of playing in the Western Conference, and specifically with the Central Division being there, you have at least five teams at first glance that could make the playoffs and kind of take away the wild card option. Do you go into the season thinking the only path to the playoffs could be finishing third or better in the Pacific?
No, I listen, we know that it's each year now, it's sort of a motherhood statement, but I think we've never seen parity like we've seen in the league now, and there's no bad teams. You know, it's there's no layups. Every game, I mean, you have to be good for 60 minutes or you're not going to win. And so, you know, we go in with that mindset. For us to even think about being a playoff team, we have to get our game in order. And then you have to play consistently long enough over the course of 60 minutes to win a game, and then over the course of play well enough, long enough over the course of the season to give yourself a chance to be in a playoff consideration. So there's a whole bunch that goes into it. We know the challenges that lie ahead of us here. You know, we're trying to just narrow it down to real small bites right now. We got to try to find a way to win a game. That's first and foremost. Let's not worry about, you know, where everything ends up in April. Right now, this is a narrow focus for us. We haven't gotten off to the start that we wanted to. We've had glimpses. We've had periods. We've had stretches that we've played well in the first three games. But we haven't done it long enough yet to earn a win yet. So, but big picture, you know, we just got to focus on ourselves and getting our game in order, you know, getting our group up to speed, and then, you know, you hopefully can put enough stretches together that at the end of the year you look and you put yourself in contention to earn a playoff berth. But we know, listen, this, you go up and down. As we said at the beginning of the year, to be a playoff team, we didn't qualify last year. So there's eight teams that are in. You're going to have to knock somebody out. We know that challenge that's ahead of us. But first and foremost, it's to get our feet under us here and start playing consistent hockey for 60 minutes, and then we'll start worrying about the rest of it then.
And Brad, last year, your thoughts on Glenn Gullitson. How is he different a coach than Bob Hartley?
Well, I think everybody's, you know, no two players, no two coaches are the same. I think Bob did a real good job, you know, in his time in Calgary, especially the 2 years that I was here. We just felt that it was, you know, he had sort of taken this group, in my opinion, as far as he could, and that's no slight. I think Bob's a terrific coach. He's won a Stanley Cup, and he's shown over time that he's won in this league, and not everybody can say that. Glenn brings a different sort of approach. There's some things that he's trying to change in terms of the way we play. You know, having the puck a little bit more, possessing the puck a little bit more, how we defend, and it takes time. It takes time. We've gone through. I've mentioned to our media locally here. It was sort of a clunky camp for us, and you know, that's not to make excuses. Everybody went through it. We didn't. You know, we had players gone for the World Cup. We had, you know, Johnny that wasn't here really for the entire camp. We had Sean Monahan was battling an injury. He was sort of skating on his own for the majority of camp. Same with Michael Backlund, came back near the end of the preseason after sustaining an injury. So we're just getting our team, our group up to speed here. But I think Glenn's an excellent communicator with the players. I think he's really intelligent from a systems and from a tactical standpoint. And I like the job that he and the coaches have done here. You know, our results aren't there yet, but I think there's parts of our game that you can see are on the come here. It's just a matter of doing it for longer stretches. But I got every confidence in the world in Glenn and the staff, and you know, now we've got to get our energy focused here to play a really good Buffalo team and try to find a way to get some points.
And wish you luck tonight.
Good-looking man at that, too, that Colleton, too. All right, Brad, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Brad.
We'll talk to you soon.
Appreciate it, guys.
Bye. Brad Treliving, general manager of the Calgary Flames. I know it's a tiny thing, but he made a pick at the draft last year on the Saturday in the sixth round that really made me happy. There's a player, he's 5'5", about 140 pounds. He plays with the Victoria Royals. His name is Matthew Phillips. And I honestly wish you would love this guy. High skill water bug. Just like all energy, go, go, go. Score like almost 40 goals last year in the Western League. He's over a point a game now for Victoria. And Calgary said, you know what? We got some multiple picks here. We're going to try Matthew Phillips. You know me. I cheer for players. I don't cheer for teams. I really hope this kid makes it.
Nice.
He's like 5'0", weighs nothing. And I really hope this guy makes it.
Well, there you go. Hey, thanks to Brad for hopping on. The Flames are by far our favorite team in Alberta because they return our calls. Now, the other team in Alberta, Edmonton, recently had a dust-up this week about the fact that after a inexcusable loss to the Buffalo Sabres, who are missing missing everybody, decided to not have their CBA-mandated day off on Monday, but instead decided as a team to practice. Now, according to the CBA, section 16.5, brackets A, the parties recognize that events may unfold, such as the monthly schedule may need to be altered or modified to adjust for unforeseen and compelling circumstances. Mark Spector on Sportsnet.ca openly wonders if a terrible, humbling, are we headed down the abyss kind of loss to the Buffalo Sabres is in fact an unforeseen and compelling circumstance or not. Where are you on CBA gate, sir?
I'm of this mind. The collective bargaining agreement cost players a lot of money. They were locked out for half a season. They could have gone an entire season without paychecks to fight for everything they had in that CBA. And one thing that we do know is once you negotiate a salary cap, every time you negotiate down. So you try to get whatever you can outside of the actual compensation. One of those things are the guaranteed days off, the mandatory days off. These are things that players lost paychecks for. And to me, the coach is angry and they lost to the Buffalo Sabres is not a traumatic situation. That is unfortunate. That is uncomfortable. But players lost money to negotiate that. Players gave up their livelihood to negotiate that into the CBA. And I don't think players should be frivolous, or organizations should be frivolous about disqualifying them because the coach is upset at his post-game press conference. That's where I'm at on mandatory practice gate.
Now, isn't this just a microcosm, though, of the labor situation in the National Hockey League? Isn't this just a microcosm of, you say players lose money and lost livelihoods and everything else, but at the end of the day, why did the CBA get settled? The CBA got settled because they wanted to come back and play. And why does a teammate on the Edmonton Oilers turn to 19-year-old captain Connor McDavid and say, yes, we're going to come to practice on Monday? It's because they want to play and want to play well. It's the same. Anybody in that room could have stood up and said, hey, CBA mandates it's a day off. We're taking a day off. But they didn't.
Let me ask
players are on board with it.
Let me ask you that. Oh, you think? See, I'm not in that room. I don't know that every player is on board with this. I know there are some that are probably on board with this. I would like to talk to the player who knew that this was, you know, players with families, with a wife and with kids, who had this as their designated day off, who now has to tell their son or daughter or wife that, no, I have to go to work, even though we've planned this for the entire month. Now, here's my other thing. Here's my other thing about it. So you go the nuclear option after game three. What if they lay an egg today against Carolina? And their off day has now been moved to tomorrow.
Well, then they'll just take a breather, think about things.
Oh, okay. So it was fine. You know what I mean? Like that's a heavy one for a coach to play this early in the season.
I want to go back to what you just said though about wives and kids and responsibilities. I mean, aren't we kind of just circling back to the fact that the most important player on the team doesn't have a wife and doesn't have kids and is all hockey all the time without anything else in life intruding on it right now?
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing.
I think this one is a big, you know, we always talk about teachable moments in the NHL. This is a real big learning moment for Connor McDavid.
Because I had to learn that, you know, as the Connor McDavid of hockey blogging, I had to learn that myself early on, that not everyone on my staff is going to be up at 3 in the morning on the East Coast.
Way. I know. Dude, writing, it's 1:30 in the morning. I just emailed you. It's 3 o'clock now. How come you haven't responded? Oh, I was sleeping because my kids exhausted me.
Right.
And one of them's sick.
Just because I'm up with, you know, some inane movie on HBO at low volume on the television with a glass of whiskey writing about, you know, the Colorado Avalanche's Corsi difference in the first three games of this season versus last season doesn't mean that, like, Leahy needs to be or Cooper needs to be or anybody else. Yeah. But that's something that you learn, is that everybody else has a life. And despite the fact that your life and your focus may be justified in trying to create something successful, as I believe mine was, in trying to create a successful blog, and I will pat myself on the back because I think it is successful, you got to consider other people, and you got to consider other people's lives. So I'll agree with you on that. I think if this was Connor's call, much like every single thing the Oilers do for the next 15 years will be Connor's call, then he has to take a step back and understand that maybe not everybody else is going to be on board with what he needs to do and what he thinks the team needs to do
now,
on
Amanda's
day off.
As I understand it, Milan Lucic was on board with this decision.
Well, come on, he's Connor's muscle.
This is a guy who just got a pretty big cookie from the Oilers general manager in the offseason, though, too. Like, okay, this is going to, you know, scalp me one day. I'll go along with it. But, you know, the point has been out there on a more, like, could you see this happening on a team that has Joe Thornton as the captain? Zero chance.
Well, no, because Joe be the first
chance.
One out the door. Joe be
no, it's our day off. We're taking it.
Hey, guys, I think we all need to, you know, really hunker down and come to practice tomorrow after that tough loss.
Yeah, Pete, there's a Dollar Fish Tacos, down at this cabana by my house in Manhattan Beach, so not gonna happen tomorrow, bud. Mandated day off.
Yeah, mandated day off. Check you out on Tuesday.
Yeah, no, not at all. But you bring up the point though, like, you know, but here's the thing, would this happen in Chicago?
Nope.
You don't think it would happen?
No.
You don't think if Q went to Taves and said, Johnny, I think we need to move the day off because we need to hunker down and fix some shit.
First of all, I don't think Quenneville would ask. Do you? Now, mind you, that's because we've got, you know, Stanley Cup success going back to 2010, whereas Todd McLellan has walked into, you know, every year is a constant excuse-making exercise. Mm-hmm. And he's walked into, okay, yeah, here we go with another rebuild, and we're going to get rid of Taylor Hall, and we're going to start all over again, and now we've got Connor and Dreisaitl we're going to build around. Like, so that team has been false-started so many times. The pressure on the Edmonton Oilers is sky high.
And you know
what? It's a shiny new building, and they're laying an egg in it.
And you know what's funny about that? Like, we talk all about how the Penguins set the template that teams are going to try to mimic as far as, like, style of play. How come teams haven't taken a clue from what the Sharks did last year? Like, part of the reason the Sharks were able to push aside all of the baggage that they had coming into last year, not only was a change behind the bench, but it was also a change in attitude. It was a change where DeBoer came in and said, hey, guess what? Tomorrow, nothing. Don't worry about hockey. Day off. And they would do this more often than not during the season to clear minds and to give veteran guys rest and to give everybody rest. I'm surprised more teams haven't looked at that and said, you know what, maybe that's the thing we need to do, because there ain't no more psychologically damaged team in this league than San Jose was coming into last year.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a really good point. And for the longest time, you know, I'm not sure if they have it in the new rink, but in the old rink, there was a sign on the door that said, you know, when you walked in the Oilers dressing room, that said, earned, not given, which the entire league kind of snickered at when you looked at all the contracts that were given to players without ever having done anything of significance. So there was that culture there. Now there's a lot of factors that go into it. It's a sensitive marketplace. We need to make sure that our key players will be here for a long time, regardless of the fact that they haven't been able to achieve anything or produce any results. We're having a hard time signing free agents. We need to send a message to the marketplace that our young core is staying here. There's a lot of things that go into locking up players that haven't had any other team or individual success.
Right.
I get that. But this is a different squad. Like, I don't know that skating yesterday makes Edmonton a better team. I know it makes a lot of fans feel better. Oh yeah, he's making them accountable. Let's show them. You know, there's the short-term battle and the long-term battle. You know, do you want to win this hand or do you want to win the game?
Right.
And I keep coming back to this. It's game 3. It's a bad one. They were bad, but now you've gone there.
Yeah.
If they stink the joint out tonight against Carolina, what then?
I don't know, it's game 3, but it was a game they weren't prepared to play against a team that was ripe for the picking. So, I mean, I'm okay with them trying to make a statement there, because that's
whose job
stop.
Is it? Whose job is it to prepare a team to be ready
Coach.
To play?
The coaches.
Now, do you think it would have been better for Todd McLellan to say, we're all wearing this one?
Yeah, probably.
I didn't prepare them properly.
Mm-hmm. The good news is that when they fire McLellan, it'll only be the first coach that Connors had that got fired there.
No, they're not going to fire Todd. That's the one thing I think they all finally get. Like, you got to leave someone there.
Yeah.
I feel bad for a guy like Dallas Eakins. I really do. Where all of a sudden, you know, the new regime is in, and all of a sudden people are saying, oh, wait a minute, so it wasn't the coach, it was the composition of the team. Oh, okay, but how many coaches did you go through? How many, you know, lives did you ruin to get there?
Yeah, that's why I feel a little bit worse for Ralph Kruger than I do for Dallas Eakins. But do you have time for a couple of listener
questions?
Yeah,
man, let's do it. Yeah, let's do all it. Right.
Steven Shapansky wants to know, how much is the new – this is sort of an Edmonton question. How much does the new building factor into a team's success? Will the Oilers' new rink help ease their failures? I don't know if it does. I mean, I think some players that from a free agent standpoint might look at a place and be like, where am I living? Where is the practice facility? And how good are the facilities inside this new building? And it may help. I mean, in Jersey's case, I think it probably definitely helped in the sense that the practice facility is attached to the new building. And the facilities inside the new building are remarkably better than the asbestos-filled crap hole that was Brendan Byrne Arena. But then you look at a situation like Brooklyn, and their practice facility is nowhere near the arena, and the arena is tough to get to, and where are you going to live? So I think it does vary from place to place.
You know what the Pied Piper is for Edmonton? Connor McDavid. The rink is gorgeous. I haven't been. Everyone that I've talked to says it's spectacular. I can't wait to go to the new rink. I can't wait to see this arena. But if you're a player, you know what attracts you there? Winning. You know why you're going to win? Because of Connor McDavid. Like, look, man. Connor McDavid heats up and scores 3 points. The Oilers win. Like, it's that simple right now in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Connor McDavid lights up 4 points. Oilers win. That's where they are right now. Show me where I'm wrong.
I'm feeling pretty good about that Art Ross pick with him, by the way.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's next level stuff.
Josh Elliott wants to know, how long until Austin Matthews starts getting criticized for not being a good Canadian boy?
I saw that tweet. Stop doing it the Canadian way. Celebrating too much. I don't know. I mean, I live in this market, and there's nothing about, oh, man, it's an American that's leading the Toronto Maple Leafs. I hear none of it.
I will predict at some point within the next 5 years, there will be a divide and conquer approach from someone like Don Cherry, where it's, you know, people are saying Austin Matthews is the best thing on this team. I gotta tell you, the engine of the Leafs is Mitch Marner. Good boy from Markham. Plays the game right. Austin Matthews gets all the headlines. Mitch Marner's the engine of the team. Makes it go.
He does like Mitch Marner.
That's what I'm saying. I don't think it's going to be criticism of Matthews,
I think it's going to be putting
Marner over as being the sneaky most important player on the Leafs versus Matthews.
I don't know, man. You know, Don every now and then will really surprise you. Remember how all in he was on Team Europe in the World Cup because everyone was disrespecting him? Now, I think that was more of a veteran thing than it was a Europe thing. Like, don't disrespect these guys. But I mean, Don's kind of gone out of his way to defend America and Americans.
Mm-hmm.
My question will be if, because Austin Matthews, even though right now, you know, the interviews are all, you know, 110%, a lot of good guys in that room, even though we're getting that in the interviews with Austin Matthews, everyone I talk to says he's got a different side to him. And when he's comfortable enough to say something, if, you know, they're going through a horrible losing streak and Austin Matthews says something to that media that they're not used to, I think at that point you'll get the, well, typical American.
Yeah.
Right? I think
Swagger.
that's when it happens. But as far as, you know, grapes give him a blast, I can't see that happening. Nor do I hear, honestly, I don't hear anything about, oh, it's an American leading the Maple Leafs.
Clantastic writes in, and I think this is an interesting philosophical question in hockey. When a team tanks, does the coach that gets there deserve plaudits or persecution? Do you credit a coach with being able to shepherd a team to a terrible season?
I don't know coaches that coach a tank, but I've met a lot of general managers, and most of them, if you catch them on a candid moment, will tell you there are plenty of days where towards the end of the season, you're really cheering for your team to lose just because of the pick. I've talked to at least a handful of guys who've admitted, oh yeah, towards the end of the season, I just want us to lose.
Mm-hmm.
I cringe every time we score.
Fans
at that point,
too?
I'm just thinking about the pick. Yeah, they're no different. Like, they see the big picture.
That's why the perfect season for the Jets right now, the New York Jets, the NFL Jets, would be to lose every other game except their division games and then make the playoffs as a 6-10 team. So you get a pretty decent draft pick, but then you also inexplicably win your division and make the playoffs. They still could do it, but the Jetsy thing would be to win the next four games and then lose again in the last week to Buffalo like we did last season. That'd be the Jetsy.
It's like what the old Norris division used to be back in the 80s, where you could win the division wish by getting 60 points. I am
right.
Not kidding. Detroit, Toronto, Chicago, St. Louis, Minnesota. Bad hockey teams.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, man, 65 points. They are free and clear in February. They're winning this thing.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we have the playoff format we have now, because other teams give those divisions side eye and be like, come on, really?
I know. Dude, I know.
All right, last one. This one's an interesting one. Darth Dangle writes in, why are there so many left-handed shots when such a small percentage of people are left-handed?
Oh, personally, do you know what? I just heard a theory about this about 6 months ago, because I've always been fascinated with this one. I have always been, and I've got two kids, and one of them shoots left and one of them shoots right. And I can remember specifically the first time I put a hockey stick in our oldest son's hands, and he looked at me, and I shoot left, so mine was on the left side, but he was across from me, and so he put his stick so it looked like it was the same way that I did, and so he's always shot right since then. Our youngest son, Brody, is a left-hand shot like his mom and dad. Don't know why. A few people have this theory that it all goes back to mini sticks. With mini sticks, you generally use your right hand, and mm-hmm. so that's the hand you're used to putting on the top. Even though technically, when you shoot with the mini stick, you're holding it with your right hand, the way the stick is angled, it's a right hand shot. I don't know that I've seen, that's just one theory. I'm just putting it out there for your consideration. I don't know which theory makes sense.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the conclusive study yet. Maybe people have done it. If you have and you're out there or know someone that's done that, please direct me to it. But I've wondered about this one my entire life and wish I have no answers. Do you?
I don't. Except to say that, you know, in baseball, you also have a really, you know, not a high, I mean, more, I'm guessing based on what the population's percentages are, there are probably more left-handed hitters and left-handed pitchers in baseball than the population at large. But in baseball, you have throws right, hits left kind of situations.
Ben Mathewson submits, if you're right-hand dominant, you generally will shoot left-handed because that's where the control comes from. Well, my son TJ, the six-year-old, is right-hand dominant. He shoots right. That's lower hand. Now, a lot of guys now are doing like top grip shooting, bottom hand grip shooting as a sort of strategy, no, not unlike, you know, the different ways of disguising the puck, white ice shot and all that kind of stuff. But I honestly don't know where it comes from. I don't think there's one sort of hard and fast rule, but predominantly a lot of people shoot left, which is why right now, if you are pregnant or your wife is pregnant, and that child comes out and you are a hockey fan and you have aspirations for this young boy or girl, whatever you can do to encourage them to shoot right, I'm just saying the roads might be paved with gold for you mm-hmm. because the world craves more right-handed shots.
Mm-hmm.
You can make money.
Oof. Yeah. As long as you remember that lefties have rights too. It's important that you remember.
For the majority, man. No.
That's right. Never forget. All right. Well, thanks to producer Sam. Thanks to Brad True Living of the Calgary Flames for joining us.
Hey, do you not want to say a word or two about the closing of the Joe Louis Arena last night? Because that's what it felt like.
It felt like that, didn't it? Everybody with the home opener. Did you have anything you wanted to say about the Joe?
Some of my earliest hockey memories, because half my family were, although scattered in the United States now, but we're in Livonia, Michigan. I spent countless times at that old dingy, dark barn. Going to watch. Remember my cousin still saying, hey, you got to come see this game. My cousin Steve bringing me because he wanted to show me Willie Huber, who at that time was the biggest player in the NHL at like 6'4" or 6'5". Heard a funny story recently that during the Pittsburgh Penguins Detroit Red Wings rivalry over Stanley Cups, in the visitors' dressing room, Detroit always had the name Detroit Red Wings painted on the wall. And one of the Penguins players, I don't know, maybe one of the goaltenders even, painted over it. And where it said Detroit Red, he painted chicken on the wall.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, the Joe. But you're right. Like, last night it was very much, like, it was the last home opener, but everybody was treating it like the place closed. Very odd.
Very bizarre feeling. Bizarre vibe there.
And also thanks to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for having both Pearl Jam and Tupac eligible for enshrinement, making my ass feel as old as I've ever felt. Now that Tupac Shakur is Hall of Fame eligible.
I get it every year around the draft, and I get it every year in junior hockey, and I got it yesterday when the first star of the week in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League was Xavier Potvin, who is the son of Felix the Cat Potvin.
My God.
I get it every year in hockey, man. I know. You get it from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I get that, too. But I'm always reminded of my age every year because of junior hockey.
Mm-hmm. Are you a Bob Dylan fan, by the way?
Yep, I am.
How much do you love him?
Highway 61 Revisited. I listened to, God, I burned that album out, university. Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't listen to a ton of Bob Dylan anymore, but there was that phase of my life where I loved Bob Dylan. You?
How much do you love the fact that the Nobel...
Can't find him.
He's not picking up his phone. They tried to give him the damn Nobel laureate, and he won't pick up the phone.
It's like when Donut Gate went down between New Jersey, you know, Jim Schoenfeld and Don Koharski, and no one could find John Ziegler. He's just pulling a John Ziegler. He's vanished. Trying to find him all weekend. Anyone find the president of the NHL? Nah, he's gone. I know.
It's like the most rock and roll thing you can do. It's something you'd expect out of, like, Guns N' Roses or something, but it's Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Bob Dylan.
Getting one of these greatest honors in the history of mankind and being
whatever.
You need it. Yeah, turn the ringer off.
Whatever. Take a message.
Bob, it's the Nobel Commission again. They want to give you a prize.
Not you.
Or it's either just great marketing to draw attention to the fact that he's just won the Nobel Prize. Which is, if you want to look at it in pro wrestling terms, maybe this entire thing with the Edmonton Oilers is just a clever ploy to draw attention and to market a hockey game tonight, because there's no way you're not watching Edmonton and Carolina tonight just to see what happens after being forced to skate on a mandatory day off.
Mm-hmm.
One of 12 games on the go tonight, I believe.
I kind of love your idea, though, that they have the Nobel ceremony. And then all of a sudden, right at the end, Rainy Day Woman 12 and 35 starts playing.
Oh, my God, that's Bob Dylan's music.
Bob Dylan's music.
I'm here to collect my prize.
Jacob, get off the stage.
Sarah, forget to charge my phone.
Yeah, one headlight, my ass. You know what I wrote?
By the way, I saw a Wallflowers and Sheryl Crow concert once at the 9:30 Club in D.C.
I bet it was great.
I bet it was a good band.
Sheryl Crow's always been on that bucket list of bands that I've wanted to see. I've never seen Sheryl Crow. I love her voice. Fantastic songs. Catchy as all F. I'll go see Sheryl Crow any day of the week. I bet she was fantastic, right?
She was fantastic. And then Jacob Dylan came out during her set and they did a duet on You're So Vain and it was just lovely.
Really?
Yeah, it was great.
Best I saw in that spirit was an Oasis Black Crows show. At the amphitheater. Yeah,
wow.
I know. And, you know, and you'll love this one because you'll probably like this band better than both these two. Guess who the opening act was?
Who's that?
Ben Folds 5. It was a great bill.
I would rank it Black Crows, then Ben Folds, then Oasis, because I was a Blur fan. So in the Blur-Oasis wars, you have to pick a side. So I picked the Blur side and not the Oasis side.
Oh, no, I went hard on Oasis.
Well, of course you did. You're a Beatles guy.
Yeah, and drugs.
And fighting. All right, that's the show. We'll talk to you again later. And, enjoy the hockeys tonight. See ya. Bye. Thank you.